We have learned to feed ourselves with the cheap labor of foreign hands. But today we pause to ask, just how cheap is that cheap labor?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 587th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Ez who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain at page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with Nikki James on the boards.
Hello.
Producers Carol Stafford.
Hello.
Parmley Taft.
Hello.
Kelsey Olson.
Good morning.
And Nick Moscagno.
How you doing?
Folks, agriculture has been and always will be a labor-intensive business. Consequently, the business of agriculture has been and always will be one of finding ways to reduce the cost of that expensive labor. One way to reduce cost is to replace expensive labor with cheap money, and with that cheap money, buy equipment and chemicals to do the work. Another way is to reduce cost. To reduce costs is to replace expensive domestic labor with a cheap labor of foreign hands. Today, much of the labor in American agriculture is carried out by the cheap labor of foreign hands, but we wonder, how cheap is that cheap labor? Here to help us explore this question, we have author, historian, and commentator Victor Davis Hanson. Victor, welcome aboard.
Thank you for having me.
Been about 8 years since we last talked, and we last talked, I think, about the land was everything.
Yes, we did.
Is the land still everything?
I think it is, yeah. I think we're starting, food prices are starting for the first time in 20 years to really soar, so people are looking at food and the land that grows it in the way that they're looking at the oil-rich Middle East or Russia or South America.
Real things.
We thought that hedge funds and real estate was what made us. We didn't realize that we still have to eat and clothe ourselves.
So when we last talked, you were a professor of classics at Fresno State.
Yes.
And now you are a one-man industry. I have to ask you, what is it that you said that so pleased the audience that you became this one-person industry?
I don't know. I think I kind of made the argument that what the average person said, the farmer, the working person who had been dismissed as a yokel or a right-wing nut, I tried.
What is the current term that...
As we hear they, I think Barack Obama said, they cling to their guns, they cling to religion, and his...
Clingers,
yes. And his Mr. Axelrod said, I think yesterday, that they were the white working class. Also, there's an essay in Newsweek this week by Michael Hirsch that says that we've lost the aristocratic patrician culture in America and that we're sort of yokels. What I was trying to suggest that these people are, in fact, very astute and bright and have been the bulwark of Western civilization across time and space. And I think that message resonated, and a lot of those people felt that they had not been treated fairly. And I grew up with a lot of them, and I don't know, I think it was a mixture of working on a farm and living in a place like Selma, plus I had a classics degree, so I had the ability, or at least the gift, from that education that was given to me to articulate what they were saying now with a sort of a theme that had been common throughout Western civilization.
And few other people were making those statements for those people, were they?
I think that's what happened, and I'm speaking as a person who's still a registered Democrat. What happened to the Democratic Party? And
are you really?
I am. I haven't voted for one on the national level since I don't know when it was, Jimmy Carter. But I still vote for my local Democratic Congressman, Jim Costa, conservative, good guy. But I think the problem was that the Democratic Party had this idea that we're seeing in the Obama campaign of us and they. They are these people who are not very educated, not very enlightened, and they need particular people like us to guide them through and make sure that they get entitlements, that we have high taxes, powerful central government to guide them so that they don't revert back to their innate superstitions and habits, which are uncouth and not sophisticated. And that destroyed, really, the Democratic Party. And I say destroyed because remember that we haven't had a Northern Democratic president since John F. Kennedy. The only time the Democrats have ever been able to elect somebody in nearly a half century is if they had a Southern accent, a Bill Clinton or LBJ or Jimmy Carter.
And John Kennedy was kind of conservative, wasn't he?
He was. He was a war hero. He was for, I guess we'd call him pro-growth capitalist, low taxes, strong national defense, promotion of idealism abroad in a muscular sense. Absolutely.
And domestically, too. Ask not what you can do for what your country can do for you. Yeah.
Absolutely. His message, I think, was quite contrary to the John Kerry, Barack Obama message.
So since we last talked, you came out with a book called Mexifornia. What on earth is Mexifornia?
Well, it wasn't my term. It was a term of pride among Mexican gang members in prisons and some La Raza people in the universities. And it's the idea that there should be no border, that California and Mexico will sort of morph into a new Mexifornian culture. And I guess the premise is that it'll still function as California, but it won't be explicitly California. By that I mean you'll still have a American standard of health care, American standard of education, American standard of construction, building codes, democracy, voting, but it won't be Americans anymore. And the fallacy of it is, of course, people are fleeing Mexico because they're rejecting a state central controlled, planned and corrupt economy, racist policies in Mexico against mestizos, and they're coming to America to get away from that. And so it would be crazy to replicate what they're fleeing here in the United States. And this idea of a Mexifornia, in fact, is not embodied so much by immigrants themselves as it is an elite who have found that the industry of racial grievance in the university, in politics, in the media has been quite lucrative for them.
Ah, there's a name for them, those people, and I'm not sure we want to use it on the radio, but yeah. I guess racial pimps.
Yeah, or race, they're part of the politics of grievance for the race industry, Reverend Wright or a La Raza professor.
So, you're a farm boy from Selma.
Yes.
Tell us what happened to Selma.
Well, Selma, when I grew up, was pretty static at 6,000 people, and now it's almost 30, and it became an edge city on one hand for Fresno, but more importantly, it became sort of that area of southern Fresno County, Kings County, Tulare County became ground zero for illegal immigration. It was safely away from the border so people could come up here. There were plentiful jobs in industries and in agriculture, meat packing plants. And almost overnight, these communities like Orange Cove, Parlier, Selma, Sanger became not just racially mixed, integrated, assimilated communities of Asians, Africans, whites, but 70% to 80% Mexican nationals. And if you go across the San Joaquin Valley to a place like Tranquility or Mendota or San Joaquin or Orange Cove or Parlier or Kiowa today, you literally will not see anybody in that community other than a Mexican national. Almost there's very few Mexican, there's some Mexican Americans, but we've created an apartheid society within the San Joaquin Valley, and parts of Los Angeles are similar,
in which essentially it is what the La Raza people in prison were saying about Mexifornia.
Yeah, it is. It's sort of Spanish is the language that's spoken, and the signs are in Spanish, and most of the customs are in Spanish. A lot of the building codes that our health codes don't apply. So if you go into a town like Parlier or out the outskirts of Orange Coast, you'll see vendors on the side of the streets without permits, or they'll just park on the side, or they'll sell things in open air markets, or you'll see three or four people living behind a house in a garage, or you'll see apartments with 15 people in them. And so it's sort of a no-go zone for the bureaucracy that says, you know, it would be racist to impose our standards of material living on other people, and it's very condescending. And the people who protect that system in the university, in the media, and in politics, of course, always end up living in exclusive enclaves of North Fresno in that area. They would never want to live in that community because of crime rates and poverty and the inability of the majority culture, us, to say to the immigrant, if you're going to come, you got to come here legally. We want to welcome you, but you got to learn English. And if you don't learn English and you don't finish high school, then you're going to end up a victim or a casualty of American capitalism. And that we don't want that for you.
Well, here we go, folks. How cheap is that cheap labor? You know, we have Victor Davis Hanson with us today. He's from the Hoover Institution, author, a historian, and a commentator, a well-known commentator throughout the United States. Also with us today, we have you, the listener. For decades, we've enjoyed the good life of cheap food, made possible in part by the cheap labor of foreign hands. But today we pause to ask, just how cheap is that cheap labor? What do you think? Pick up your phone and join us today. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Question of the day, how cheap is cheap foreign labor? When we get back, I'd like to ask Victor about what this means to him as a farmer in Selma and what life is like on that farm in Selma as a consequence of Mexifornia. Right back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain. Today we're talking about the cheap labor of foreign hands. And folks, you know, we've made a living on the cheap labor of foreign hands for many years, but today we're pausing to ask just how cheap is that foreign labor? What do you think? We have Victor Davis Hanson here to help us out with this question, and it's great to have him aboard. Last time we had him was about 8 years ago, and we talked about his book, The Land is Everything. And today's one of your latest books is Mexifornia. What else do you have out?
Since that book appeared.
Just a sec here. There you go.
Since that book appeared, I wrote a book, two military histories, and then the latest was a book on the Peloponnesian War, a war like no other. So I've been trying. I'm by training a classical historian, but I wrote that more as a memoir of the world that I grew up in.
It's interesting. I guess we share something in that we both wrote about agriculture, and then we both wrote about military history. So,
yeah.
Is there something in the water? I wanted you to tell some stories about what your life is like in that bucolic setting of a farm in Selma.
Well, it is very bucolic. We have it was part of a 140-acre tree and vine farm, and then when my parents passed away, we divided it, and I still have 45 acres of Thompson seedless grapes and the original house that my great-great-grandmother built in 1870. So it's my son lives there now. He's the sixth generation that lived there. I think what I saw and what prompted the book Mexifornia was this, I guess it would be called the life cycle, where I saw a lot of very hard-working young Mexican nationals from places like Oaxaca or Chiapas come here, work without English, without maybe any more education in the eighth grade, and come and make a fantastic amount of money compared to what they had seen in Mexico, $8 an hour versus $1, say, a day. And then thinking that that was the land of milk and honey, age, so that people got heavier, their joints got sore, they hurt their back, they hurt their arm. After 30 years of that, then the farmer no longer needed them or could not use them, because only a person could, for a very short period of time, can lay cement or pick plums with 40 pounds on their back. And then they were thrown out on the entitlement industry for their health care, their legal needs, their educational needs, food stamps, Section 8 housing. And that cost was passed on to the consumer. And then the farmer or the meat packer or the hospitality industry then said, "Bring your nephew, and I want him." And then we went back with an 18-year-old. And meanwhile, the person who was not able to do that drudge labor anymore at 50 and had not become a supervisor or had not learned English or had not got an education so that that was not just an entry-level job, as it had always been for other people, then they had a second generation, and there was not such a good message to transmit to that generation. It wasn't, we came from Mexico and we're rich, wealthy now. It's, we came from Mexico and we don't have anything, and we don't know English, we're not educated, and we're bitter. And that second generation is the one that I'm worried about, because if you look at high school graduation rates, illegitimacy rates, drug use, criminality, it's quite disturbing, because they didn't come from Chiapas or Oaxaca, and they were born in the United States, and they don't see anything to contrast it well, and they see what happened to their parents. And the message that they got in the university or the elite media was sort of ethnic chauvinism, separatism, rather than assimilate, integrate, intermarry, get educated, see yourself as an American. If you want to go pick grapes, see that as a summer job, and then you can transcend that. And that's where we are now. So you're right in your original formulation that it's a fool's paradise to think that the labor's cheap. Nothing's cheap. When you hire somebody for $8 to $10 an hour from Oaxaca what I call the three strikes against him, he doesn't know English, he's not here legally, and he has no education. The clock starts ticking. He's got to find English, he's got to get an education, and he's got to get legal almost immediately. If he does not, he's going to end up a casualty of the system.
And there are many casualties.
Absolutely. We have somewhere between 12 and 16 million people here illegally, and at least half of those people are in dire straits because they don't know English, they're not here legally, and they don't have any education.
Well, in the past few years, there's been, 10 million people crossing the border into the United States illegally to take up residence. So what happened to the rule of law?
I don't know. I thought that was the greatest casualty of this experiment. And I say experiment because people will say, we've always had illegal immigrants. Well, we've had some, but we've never had it at this magnitude after 1980. In 1980, we had about 3 million people here illegally. And we've had almost a million people come in per year and then some leave. But what happened to the rule of law? I think the idea was that we are a liberal, caring, progressive society, and we have an open border, and everybody's going to come here, love America as they did in the 19th century, and assimilate. And we forgot that we were no longer sending them the message that our great-grandparents learned, or what our grandparents sent, meaning if you come to America, we want you. But be careful, it's a tough society. It's a rat race, it's competitive, and the clock ticks. So learn English, become an American, integrate, accept Jefferson and Lincoln as your own. And instead, we gave the message to this new generation of immigrant, we don't care if you come here illegally. If you want to live in East L.A. or Orange Cove and only hang out with Mexican people, that's fine. You know what? If you come to the university, we're going to tell you that Montezuma is just as good a person as Lincoln. And you know what? We're going to say that La Raza culture is no different, no better, no worse than American painting or literature or Mark Twain. And you know what? We're not going to impose our values on you. And you know what? As long as you come and work and you keep to yourselves, we don't really care much what you do as long as you don't break the law. That was the attitude, the message that we sent. And we should have been saying, if you come here, you're going to come here legally, like the Irish or the Jews or the Germans, and you know what? We're going to treat you the same way, and we want you to be assimilated, integrated, and intermarried within this society. And it was a combination of racial identity politics on the part of La Raza leaders who took advantage of that system and became very powerful, influential, and lucrative business. But it was also a feeling of white guilt among liberal Americans who did not want to associate, live next to, talk to the other. And therefore, as a psychological mechanism, they said, you know what? I'm going to adopt this live-and-let-be attitude, and I will patronize the Mexican national. He's over there in Watsonville. That's great. But you know what? I just so long as he does not move up to Aptos next door to me, or if he does come up to Aptos, make sure he's cutting my lawn rather than his kids and my kids going to school together. That attitude of separatism disguised in a liberal worldview was absolutely devastating to the immigration problem.
You know, you think of the great flood of people that came through Ellis Island, and then from Ellis Island, you know, went to the boroughs of the Bronx, for example, and hashed it out there, and had to come to grips with assimilating into this country.
Yes, he did.
And yet we don't see that at all here in Mexifornia, if you will, or Mexitexas, or...
Yeah, we don't, because, so many people are enriched by the present non-system. The Mexican government, for example, gets $50 billion in remittances that props up a corrupt economy run by a couple million people. And it gets a safety valve situation where any dissident will go to the United States rather than march on Mexico City. And then it gets an expatriate community that the further and the longer they're distant from Mexico, the more they romanticize Mexico and become a potent lobby. And that helps Mexico. So Mexico exports human capital. And people here, the La Raza race industry wants more constituents who need collective representation. And then the employers and big business and corporation America want cheap labor. And between those three groups, we have the present system.
Ooh, okay. So what is the cost of this cheap labor when we get back from this break? That's the question we're going to put on the table. Is there an objective way to measure how much cheap labor really costs? Folks, the phone number is today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We have Victor Davis Hanson with us. And, of course, we have you. What do you think? This is your world, from sea to shining sea. It seems to be pretty much the case, not only here in California, but throughout the United States. Even way up there in my home turf of Montana, it seems to be the same. What do you think? How much does cheap labor really cost? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We will be right back with Victor Davis Hanson from the Hoover Institution and you. So please do stay tuned. There. This is Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about labor and how we have become a nation that has come to rely on cheap labor of foreign hands. It's how much of our food is brought to our table. But yet, we wonder, how much does that cheap labor really cost? And here to help us with that question, we have Victor Davis Hanson. Is there any way to objectively, Victor, get a handle on how much cheap labor really costs? It's like, I came to this question because I heard somebody talking about reparations for the African American community.
Yes.
Because some plantation owners centuries ago decided that they could have cheap labor for their cotton plantations and tobacco plantations by importing slaves from Africa. And so today, a couple hundred years later, we're talking about reparations. And I got to thinking, well, if we give every person in the African-American community a couple, I don't know, how much it costs to assuage our guilt?
I don't know, but we'd have to start. We would have to start with a Japanese internment. We've given each of them $20,000. Then we would go to the Chinese who were blown up by the Union Pacific Railroad. Then we could start with the Irish that were treated just like cannibals.
But at any rate, so I get back to the notion in thinking about all of these reparations, and I come to realize that, hey, wait a minute. That cheap cotton really wasn't cheap at all. It might have been the most expensive agriculture commodity to ever been devised by the human mind, when the full costs are thrown into there. And so I'm kind of looking at what we're going through today and wondering what the real cost is of our cheap labor. And, you know, somebody sent me a bunch of numbers. I have no idea how accurate they could be, but they talk about us now spending $90 billion per year on illegal or undocumented immigrants.
Well, I know that the cost to incarcerate not American citizens, but Mexican nationals in California per year is about $700 million, which was the budget of several UC campuses. And for example, we set up UC Merced to appeal to people from diverse backgrounds. Its budget's about $30 million. For the amount of money that we spend to incarcerate, I think it's 20,000 Mexican nationals at $40,000 a year. $800 million, we could have made, you know, 20 UC Merceds. So
30% of the federal prison population in the United States are Mexican nationals.
Yes, so it's enormous cost, and if you factor in duplicate ballots, duplicate television, radio, government ads, if you factor in needs for special, and we had for years bilingual education, educational problems, court interpreters, the whole idea of replicating everything we do in the government in a different language, you have enormous cost.
I guess it's government times two.
It is, and it's the cost is directly attributable to our own lack of creativity, industry, and courage in saying to the Mexican national, come here legally. We want you to come here legally. We're not going to let you anymore be exploited by the Mexican government, the people in the race industry, or our own corporate people who exploit your labor. And we want you to come here legally, maybe 100,000, 200,000 a year. We will assimilate, and you're going to be treated just like anybody else who comes from the Philippines or South Korea. We're not going to privilege you. We're not going to punish you. And I think that I had a debate once with a Chicano studies professor, and I said, what would happen if a freighter beached every day off San Francisco Bay and 3,000 Chinese nationals?
This happened?
Yes, it does.
It happened.
What would you do? And he got very angry and said, we couldn't do that. It would be illegal. These people have no business here. But see, it's not just white, black in America anymore. It's Asian, it's Indian, it's Korean, it's Filipino, it's Chicano, it's black. We have all of these different racial groups, and the only thing that will make a cohesive nation is a common language, a common culture, a common vision.
So what about multiculturalism?
There's no such thing. It's multiracialism is fine, but you say multiculturalism. Does that mean the Mexican national comes to Santa Cruz and says, you know, I demand that Dominican hospital be just like the one I left in Mexico. I demand that the attitude toward religion or race is exactly like it's in Mexico. Does somebody come from Saudi Arabia and say, I demand that we bar Christianity like we did in Saudi Arabia? Or somebody from Iran says, I demand there won't be any bikinis on this Santa Cruz beach. So nobody says, I want to have medical practice like they have in Libya. I was operated in Libya with a ruptured appendix. Believe me, the great multiculturalist in any university, if they'd go to Libya today, that socialist paradise, would not want to be operated under third world protocol. So what I'm saying is that in the back of our mind, we all accept that this Western system works, even though we have this boutique critique of it. But the way we eat, the way we travel, the way we have medical care, the way we vote, the way we treat each other is a unique system that grew up in Europe and had its origins in classical Greece and Rome. And people from Mexico know that. People who come to the United States.
That's what they're coming for.
We have more immigrants than all countries in the world put together each year.
Let's go to the phones and see what our audience has to say. Rich, welcome to the Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Victor Davis Hanson.
Hello?
Go ahead, you're on.
Yeah, hi guys. Yeah, this is one of my favorite subjects here. You know, the first thing is that this is an agenda, and we're trying to talk logic to people that have an agenda, which is overall one world government and control. And they're trying to do that with the North American Union here, with Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. That's why we won't build our border on the southern end of the United States, but we'll go to Palestine and Egypt and build a border for them over there, using the Corps of Engineers and our money.
Okay, your question?
What I wanted to say is, right now in Australia, the state of Queensland has been taken over by a corporation called the Bigelow Corporation that was given to them by the Australian government. And everybody who owns land there no longer owns land in Queensland. They're not allowed to grow animals or food without the Bigelow Corporation's okay. And this is part of what they're trying to do in various parts of the world. It's going to happen here, too, if we don't stop it.
Okay,
the illegal immigration is just one of the problems that this leads to. That's why they don't close the borders.
Yeah. Well, okay, I think we're having a war, and we're seeing it in the current election, of what I would call the elites and the much caricatured middle classes who the elites feel cannot make informed decisions because they're not educated or they're captives to religious superstition or pernicious customs and
the clingers.
Clingers of the United States. They cling to the Jacksonian view of America. So that's
going to call ourselves the Klingons, by the way.
Yeah, well, the problem with it is that the so-called clingers are the people who created the country. I don't mean that in a racial sense, but the average Jacksonian, and they keep the country moving, and it's the person who puts the gas in Al Gore's carbon-burning private jet, or the person.
Oh yeah, he won't give up any of his.
No,
this is the old communist system.
The person who built Reverend Wright's mansion, these people, or who planned, or the architect who designed it, they're not to be laughed at. They have expertise, and they have certain values that makes this country unique and exceptional.
Well, that's why they're pushing this global warming, too. All the decisions made that are creating our problems are from our government.
Hey, Rich.
Not to drill our oil.
Hey, Rich.
What?
How cheap is cheap food?
It isn't cheap anymore, and it wasn't designed to. The overall plan is to reduce the population of this world.
Okay, thanks for your comments,
500 million
Rich.
People, that's
appreciate
what they're
it. Folks, this is Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We have Victor Davis Hanson, and we're talking about cheap labor. And we're wondering, how cheap is that cheap labor? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We have callers on the line, so we'll get to them when we get back. But we are curious to know what you think. And when we get back, I would like to ask how immigrant labor coming in from south of the border is different, really, than the waves of immigration we've had in the past. And Victor Davis Hanson has an answer right back. Hey, welcome back. Michael Olson, this is The Food Chain. We have a caller who called in for Victor Davis Hanson. He asked a question, made a statement, actually. He said, Mr. Hanson, I suppose you're going to tell us that all of the workers on your 40-acre farm over there in Selma speak perfect English and are all Americans.
No, I'm not. In fact, one of the reasons that I left farming, in the sense that I leased it out to somebody, was I didn't have an answer to that problem. And so I farmed it myself. I can tell you that I had an I-9 form, and I followed the letter of the law for every single person that was there. And by 1995, the people we were hiring were Mexican-Americans, and that became very difficult because it was almost a demand that you pay people who were American citizens in cash because they had other income, some of it government subsidized. But I rented my brother, and I'll be quite candid, my twin brother and older brother and cousin went bankrupt, partly for that reason of trying to ensure that everybody was legal and that they tried to hire American citizens, and they couldn't compete given the prices of food. And then when they went bankrupt in 2002, I leased my vineyard out, and I have my renter there, and he uses all legal labor, but I'm almost positive all of them are people who either are Mexican-American or from Mexico.
Okay, let's go to Richard on the lines. Folks, the phone number is today 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Richard, welcome to The Food Chain.
Thanks. Dr. Hanson, I really admire your work, and I especially liked reading A War Like No Other.
Thank you.
I wondered if you can think of examples in history that had where countries had analogous immigration problems and what they did or how it turned out.
And to add on to this, what about Western Europe?
Yes, well, we have a good example right now in Western Europe where there's 20 million people from North Africa, mostly in Turkey, Muslims, who have not integrated well. We have an advantage in the United States because the people who are coming here are from a similar religion. They're proximate in location. And this is a meritocratic society where we don't judge somebody by their accent or even their race. And we assimilate much better. We can solve this problem if we'll just go back to our fundamentals. In Europe, it's a little different. Where you're born, where you're educated, how you speak a language locates you in a class sense. And then the problem with Islam is it's not an assimilative religion in Europe. And so you go to a place like, I go to Europe four or five times a year to speak, and boy, you go to places in the French suburbs, the Parisian suburbs, or parts of Athens, or
the Champs-Élysées.
Exactly, and even Rotterdam now, and it just seems like a different world. And there's the same ingredients are there, and it's a warning sign. And we can go back through history and look at what happened along the Rhine and Danube in the 3rd and 4th century A.D. People were coming across. There was a zone that was neither Roman nor German or Dalmatian, and there was enormous problems.
Follow-up, Richard?
I guess I have just a completely off-the-wall question. Did anyone ever put out an audio book of War Like No Other?
I think they did, and they did Mexifornia as well. I think most of the last six or seven are on tape. I didn't do them because I don't read very well, but I think they're all out now.
What do you mean you don't read very well?
Well, I don't read out loud very well, put it that way.
Richard, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Helen, who has what I think is the future question. Helen, welcome to the Food Chain. You've got Victor Davis Hanson and Michael Olson. Go ahead.
Hello. Well, my question is that how do we get people to pay what the food is worth? Because, I mean, agriculture is about the most important industry in the world. Without it, we just have nothing. No countries, no people, no nothing. And yet the people who work in it are sort of, I mean, they're so underpaid and they're considered some kind of dirt almost, you know.
Absolutely.
And completely unappreciated.
I think so, too.
When I
started farming in 1980, the price of raisins, sun-made raisins, to the farmer was $1,200 a ton. And the price of labor was $6 an hour. The price of sulfur was $2 a bag. And this year we're getting the same price, $1,200 a ton. Sulfur is $20 a bag. And labor is $10 to $12 an hour.
And diesel.
And diesel's $4 a gallon. It was 78 cents.
With the food on the world market, if you charge more, then the people will buy it from Chile or something instead. So how do you get people to pay what it's worth?
It's very hard to, because what people don't buy quality either. They buy, and they say they do. Santa Cruz is an informed community and has farmers markets and such,
yeah.
But most people will go and buy the cheapest product, and that means somebody who's vertically integrated, a large corporate farm who controls the packing, the distribution, this merchandising, has an enormous advantage. But that being said, I think we're getting into a new frontier now where everything from aluminum to sulfur to oil is scarce, because we have 6 billion people, and 2 billion of them, 2 billion in India and China, are now not only wanting a Western lifestyle, but are having the accumulated capital to
purchase
it.
All our capital.
And they're bidding on the world market. They're bidding for almonds. They're bidding for everything, from oil to precious metals. And I think you're going to start to see, especially when one quarter of all corn acreage in the United States goes to ethanol, we're going to see a spike in food prices like we've never experienced.
One thing we can do, Helen, is to patronize our local agriculture.
Yes.
Go out and buy some food with its farmer's face on it, and with your money, build an industry.
Uh-huh.
And make those people prosperous, because
uh-huh.
we're going to need them as this new world order that Victor Davis Hanson speaks of emerges. We're going to need that local agriculture. Thank you so much for the call, Helen.
Yes.
This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. When we get back, we have a question from Bill, and it'll probably be enough to close out the hour with Victor Davis Hanson. And it is an amazing hour when we think about the implications of the true costs of cheap food. And when we look to the future, what do we see? And that'll be a question we want to ask Victor when we get back. Please do stay tuned. Well, a little bit of time, but so much good stuff to talk about. We're going to go quickly to Bill. Bill, welcome to the Food Chain.
Yeah, it seems as though Oklahoma and Arizona have a way of getting the illegal aliens to deport themselves with the laws that they put on the employers. I'm just wondering what it's going to take for our bureaucrats and legislators to get on the bandwagon.
You know, that's a great question. And in the break, I was just talking with Victor Davis Hanson about my last question. Is that is there a way of breaking up this unholy alliance of strange bedfellows between those who want cheap labor and care not about the consequence, and those who want cheap voters and care not about the consequence? Is there a way of putting an end to that weird coalition? That's
I think there is. I think that what's happening is we're having a four-part solution. We're going to make it more difficult to cross the border with fences at about 800 miles. We're going to have employer sanctions. We're already starting to see some of that. We're beefing up the security. And then we're changing the ideology and the mentality of the average American. If you look at any poll now, 70% of the people do not support illegal immigration. They're not just so-called white people. They're Asians who can't get a relative. They're people from India who have to have a PhD to get in. They're people from Korea. They're African Americans. So I think there's no public support for it anymore. And we're changing the idea. I think we're going to get back, within 10 years, we're going to get back to the idea you must learn English, that government documents, it won't work any longer to have Spanish, Tagalog, all of these Korean, Chinese. So we're going to get back to one language because we know the alternative. We look at Rwanda, we look at the Balkans, we look at Iraq, and the worst thing that there is sectarian violence.
And turn in tribalism.
Tribalism, where your first allegiance is always to your first cousin or to someone who looks like you rather than to an
or
idea.
Or to your religion or...
Yeah, we can't have that. It doesn't work. It's never worked in history. It doesn't work today. And this country is the only real multiracial country that works, and it only works because we have a shared, common, unique culture. And we have to get back to that or we're not going to make it.
So do you see any hope for the future?
I do, because I do see that... people of all different races are starting to wake up now and say, you know what, we're all mixed up, we're marrying people of different races as never before. We understand that multiculturalism, having your food, having your music is great, but it's not the same as a common core of government, politics, economics, private property that we all share. And so I think this new generation has been lectured and hectored at so much by the 60s generation that they are sick and tired. As one student told me, if I have to see another bespeckled, long-haired guy, 60, with tenure, making $100,000, where I go to 7-Eleven and pay my tuition and get lectured at, off-topic lectures, I'm going to puke. That sort of summed up that generation's attitude toward my generation.
Is there a difference between multiculturalism and no culturalism?
Well, multiculturalism, no, it is no culture. It's just such a mishmash that there is no common culture, and it's just chaos, anarchy. And it's a very different concept than the noble American idea of multiracialism, which is should be defended.
Victor Davis Hanson, Hoover Institution, author, lecturer, world raconteur. Thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you out there for joining us. If you didn't get a chance to log in your comments, and many of you did not, you can do so by logging on the forum page at metrofarm.com, letting us know what you think the true cost of cheap labor really is. Until next week, remember, cheap food isn't. Thank you so much, Victor Davis Hanson.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.